for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program. Welcome to the American Federation of Government Employees Inside Government Program, brought to you in part by MetLife. Now, here's your host, Jason Fornicola.
This week, we'll continue our coverage of AFGE's National Convention with Housing and Urban Development Council 222 Executive Vice President Carolyn Fedoroff and former National President Bobby Harnage. But first, Social Security Administration Council 220 President Witold Skwierczynski joins us. Witold, welcome back to the program.
Glad to be here.
We are, of course, sitting today at AFGE's National Convention here in Las Vegas. Set the scene for us. What have you been up to so far?
Well, I've got here 3 days ago. We've had our own council convention. It's a two-day convention where we set the policy for our council. Our council consists of, we had over 100 delegates here representing locals throughout the country that represent Social Security employees who work in field offices in our, on our 800 number. And so we had a very fruitful debate about a number of issues, and we had elections, so we just finished those last night. I happened to get reelected, so SSA has to deal with me for 3 more years. And I think we have a very we have some changes in our executive committee. I think we have some solid folk, hard workers, and people who are dedicated to representing Social Security employees and making our agency a vital, vibrant agency.
Coming out of your convention, do you have a renewed sense of energy to attack some of the issues that are going on in the federal workforce?
Yeah, sure do. We're under the gun. You know, I see that while we're here meeting, the Republican candidate Romney selected Ryan as his vice presidential candidate. He's no friend of Social Security or Medicare. So we know that we have a fight in front of us if folks like that have a chance to run the government. So our folks are very energized. We're interested in making sure that Social Security stays in place and has a decent benefit structure for the American people, and that the employees have good working conditions and have also good pay and benefits.
Of course, Congressman Ryan is known for his budget proposal in the House. Talk to some of the issues that he brought up in his budget proposal and explain them to the audience, how they would impact Medicare and Social Security.
Well, the Ryan budget proposal, as in terms of Social Security, the House actually passed his budget proposal recently, and it would result in a 2,500 full-time equivalent employee cut in our staff and Social Security. Now, we've had two large cuts in the last two fiscal years. About 4,000 employees were cut from our budget in FY11. It's projected that we'll lose about 2,500 in this fiscal year, FY12, and with that budget from Ryan, would lose approximately 2,500 more in FY13. Now, that would be a cut of 9,000 people in Social Security in a three-year period. We'd be back to staffing levels below what we had in 2007. And since 2007, we've had a 30% increase in retirement and survivor claims and a 25% increase in disability claims. So we've had significantly more work since 2007, and under the Ryan budget, our staffing would go below 2007 levels. That's going to result in a lot of problems with regards to our ability to do the work of the American public with regards to Social Security claims.
What do you think the American public's response will be if those things continue out? I mean, we're talking about increasing the work, decreasing the staff to do it. I mean, that's a real problem, right?
That's a significant problem. We're looking at, for instance, just in a two-year period, if this, under this Ryan budget that passed the House, we're looking at $350,000 increase in the disability backlog. That means that we take the disability claims and they will not be processed as quickly as before. And once you get a backlog like that, you create all kinds of problems in terms of processing the claims, because because we don't have the staff to do it in an expeditious manner. And that means that disabled people who come to Social Security will face significantly more delays in terms of how quickly their claims will be processed. Right now, claims processing is running about 111 days. Under this scenario, processing time might increase by as much as 70 more days. So that's over 2 months of additional time that somebody's going to have to wait to just get a decision in their claim. And if their decision is the denial and they choose to engage in the appellate process, it's going to take longer there also. So these, when Congress talks about cutting government, it has a significant effect on the level of service that we provide.
So we're looking at potentially 180 days just for a decision. That doesn't even include waiting to get the check, which is what people need to pay the bills and put food on the table.
Right. That's from taking the claim to a decision. Then there would be an additional delay with the decision. The decisions are pretty automated, though. You can get the check out pretty quickly once you get a decision. But, yeah, it'll take that long.
Do you think people understand the ramifications of that, of some of these policies and the decisions that are being made to cut government and the services?
No, I don't. And I think it's our job as union officials who represent employees in Social Security. We've always prided ourselves in AFGE and Social Security as not only being fighters for our employees that we represent, but also for the program itself, because the most people who work for Social Security, you don't get rich working for Social Security on a government salary, despite what people may think. And folks are very dedicated to the program and want to provide good service for the public. Our members demand that we go to Congress and seek additional resources for the agency so to make the claims processing more efficient and quicker. And the public doesn't generally know how the cause and effect what budget cuts have, and it's our job to inform people of that, because people will make, I think, different choices if they know that budget cuts have an adverse effect on service. Like, for instance, budget cuts have resulted in the agency closing many field offices, removing the ability to have face-to-face service in their communities. A lot of our constituents that we service have a difficult time dealing with us in any manner other than face-to-face. The agency certainly has instituted in the last 5 or 6 years internet claims that allow people to file on the internet, but many our employees who we survey periodically on the quality of internet claims tell us that they're fraught with error, and if individuals make mistakes in filing their internet claims, they're often mistakes that adversely affect their benefits. Some segments of the population, because of language barriers or because of disabilities that they have, just can't deal with our agency without assistance from a Social Security worker. So it's important to have a clear option for people to be able to file claims either on the telephone or face-to-face at a field office. And when you close field offices, you really remove a level of service that many of our constituents won't have otherwise.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're here with Witold Spierczynski, the president of AFGE's SSA Council 220 Field Operations Locals. Witold, what do some of the customers of SSA say to you about field office closings, reduced hours, and those sorts of things?
Well, a lot of people are upset. We now have had for over a year, about a year and a half now, our offices have closed a half hour early. And the public certainly is upset about the limitations to field office service. We have people in certain communities where field offices are closing are extremely upset about the fact that they no longer have a community-based service. I'll give you an example. The agency just announced a closing in Ketchikan, Alaska. Now, Ketchikan, Alaska is in southwestern Alaska. It's a relatively small community. The only way that you can have face-to-face service people now in Ketchikan after that office closes is to either fly or take a boat to Juneau. There is no road that goes from Ketchikan to Juneau. When we had a discussion with agency management in Baltimore, the national level, about closing that office, they said, management said, well, they could just drive to the closest office. Well, there is no road. That's how much they don't even know their own structure of their field offices. So you close an office like that, and vulnerable people who live in Ketchikan basically have no service from Social Security. Now, we've had office closings in a couple offices closed in Seattle. One is on the block in Louisville West. Now, in those two cases, what they're doing is they're closing offices, three offices in total. And in Seattle, they're closing two offices and opening an office in a federal building. And in Louisville, they're closing an office and asking the employees and the public who's serviced by that office to move to a current office that exists in a federal building. The problems with having offices in federal buildings are that there's security issues in order to have access to the building. We have about 15 to 20% of our clientele does not have photo IDs. They can't get into a federal building. So they can't get into the new field office in Seattle or in Louisville. Now, we have a part of our population that's homeless. Now, they may have an ID or not have an ID, but you're not going to take all your worldly belongings over to a federal building and leave them on the street to get into the office. Part of our population may have legal issues, where if you go to a federal building and check the ID, they may get arrested. For whatever reason, they're then reluctant to deal with the Social Security Administration on their Social Security issues. So there's all kinds of problems when you do these office closings. The Louisville, the community there is up in arms because that office particularly that they're closing services a 90% black population. The staff in the office mirrors the population. There's parking there, free parking for both employees and the public that doesn't exist in a federal building. And the agency just is ignoring these kinds of issues when they close the office.
As you know, many people with certain feelings think that Social Security should be cut or that there should be privatized parts of it or all of it. What do you say to those people who don't feel the same way as you do about the organization?
There's a good portion of the American public that their only source of income is their Social Security check. And when people talk about cutting back on Social Security, they have to understand that Social Security checks are not large. The average retirement benefit's about $1,200 a month, and it'd be difficult to live on $1,200 a month. Now, people who get Social Security checks, Social Security is insurance. They paid into Social Security, and they deserve, you know, the benefit that they're going to get back. And Social Security is vital for eliminating poverty in the United States. If you mess with Social Security and reduce the benefits, it's probably going to result in an increase of poverty in the United States, and I don't know why we want that.
If you could change one thing about Social Security, implement one fix, what would it be?
Well, if you're looking at the future solvency of the program, right now, there's a cap on taxation of a little bit over $100,000. I think it's $103,000. And wealthy people who make more than $103,000, they no longer pay on their wages any Social Security tax. I would eliminate the cap. It would be fair to eliminate the cap. And that would basically eliminate any solvency question in the future about Social Security. So that's probably one thing I would do to relieve the fear that the public has that's been drummed into their head that Social Security is on the verge of bankruptcy, which it's not. It's projected to be solvent for another 25 years, just without making any changes. But after that, you know, theoretically there may be some problems. So steps will have to be made in the future, if not now, and in the future to deal with that solvency problem. And I think that step is a step that most people would accept, that it's a fair taxation step. Why should people who make $100,000 and less pay tax on all their income, whereas people who make more than $103,000 are exempt from Social Security tax once they hit that limit? It's a fairness issue. When I've talked to groups who aren't that familiar with Social Security, they all agree. In fact, they're outraged when they find out that there's a segment of the population that doesn't pay Social Security tax on all their wage.
Let's shift gears for a minute. One thing that you have worked tirelessly on the last several years is getting a contract for your workers, coming to an agreement with Social Security, which is something that you were able to agree to not too long ago. but with a couple of things outstanding. Give us an update on where things are today.
Well, we reached an agreement on a national contract at the end of April, and we went through a ratification process that was concluded at the end of June. We signed off on our agreement July 11th, and it became effective July 16th. Part of the agreement left out some outstanding issues, which we couldn't come to agreement with. But what the parties decided is let's negotiate those issues later and try to come to an agreement with the rest of the bulk of the contract, implement it, and deal with the issues later. So that's what we did. Now we've dealt with these other issues, and the other issues are we have a proposal on the table to have expanded bargaining rights for the union, and we have our entire appraisal article, our entire merit promotion article, an article on work at home, FlexiPlace, and an article about temporary FlexiPlace, work at home by exception, we call it, for people who become disabled and have difficulty commuting to the workplace. So those are the five issues that are outstanding. And we've had two bargaining sessions since we made this agreement that we're going to bargain these things later and gotten nowhere. So last week, on Wednesday, in fact, we submitted these articles to the Federal Services Impasses Panel and asked for their assistance on reaching a resolution on five issues.
How has the morale of the workers improved since the contract was agreed to?
Well, the workers, they had about a 90 in the field. We had about a 90% ratification vote. They were very pleased with the product. We have some additional benefits in the product. We have expanded. We have a vision program that pays for eyeglasses and eye exams, and we've increased the amount that we reimburse on eyeglasses and eye exams. We have on a transit subsidy. We increased the amount on a transit subsidy. In our awards article, we came up with a range of awards for people who reach a certain appraisal ratings. And to make it it's a much more fair system. Management had the option under the old contract to give people an award if they hit a certain appraisal rating. Now it's mandatory. So those three things are money issues that where the employees are advantaged. It's kind of early to judge because the contract's only been in effect for about 3 weeks to see further reaction from the employees. But the problem, see, we're really not done because these issues that are outstanding are critical. We think that the merit promotion, this kind of things that the agency has on the table on the merit promotion system, we think would result in a high possibility that they could manipulate the merit promotion system in a way that would violate merit systems principles, where they could target people for promotions much more easily than the current system. They want to considerably reduce the areas of consideration. I mean, we're a national organization, and they want to have a very narrow, geographically narrow ability for people to, and component narrow ability for people to put in for jobs. They want to implement a scoring system on applications, which we think is completely unfair. They don't want any union involvement in figuring out that scoring system. And the appraisal article, for instance, we've asked for simple things like we have a three-tier appraisal system. We've asked for contract language. We've proposed that they have to inform an employee of what they have to do, what level of service they have to provide in order to reach the top level in the appraisal system, and they refuse to agree to that language. And we've asked for another simple thing is like, if you're going to have an appraisal system, the employee ought to know up front how they're going to be measured. So we've put in a simple proposal that says at the beginning of the appraisal period, you will inform each employee of what measurement systems will be used in order to evaluate the performance. The agency has refused to agree to that. We've put in language about things, the outside forces that may affect their ability to reach their performance level, such as, you know, there's a lower staffing level in the office, or the employee was absent because of illness, and that these kinds of things have to be taken into consideration when they're appraising people. They refuse to agree to the bulk of our language there. So we had no choice but to say these are basic fairness issues that we had no choice but to say we're going to go to the impasses panel and seek their assistance on these issues.
Not agreeing to those items that you described. Mm-hmm. What is the motivation behind that? Do you think that it's because they genuinely don't think it's a good idea, or is it because the union proposed something and we're just going to be adverse to it no matter what?
No, I think the agency, you got to remember that even though we've had a Democratic president, President Obama, for 3.5 years, the Commissioner of Social Security is a holdover, Commissioner Astruz. And I think if you look, if you analyze, you know, what he's done with regards to hiring and promoting people, he's clearly interested in having a younger workforce and a different culture in the agency. And I think that's to the detriment of the current workforce. For instance, in merit promotion, we formerly had factors and weights, the scoring system that you would use to determine where if somebody made a best qualified list to be picked on a when somebody applied for a vacancy. We formerly had things like the amount of experience you had. You think that'd be important? Your appraisal rating. You think that, you know, people who score high, have a high appraisals, ought to be the ones you're looking for to get promoted. Whether you got any awards, you think that'd be high on the list as a factor for promotional activity. Well, the system that they want to put in place, and actually they have, this is a long story, they have put in place illegally, we've won a grievance on this, and where the arbitrators told them they have to change the system back to what we had in our old contract, eliminates all those things and just has a questionnaire. And the questionnaire asks questions such as, do you have experience, you know, doing a certain task? And if you did it for a day, you could truthfully answer yes. Whereas under the old system, you'd max out in points if you did it for 6 years. So they're looking at a younger, and they've manipulated this system to try to get younger workers promoted over veteran employees. And we just, you know, we have nothing against younger workers, and certainly they, you know, they should have promotional opportunities too, but not to the exclusion of your veteran employees. So we have a real problem with the system, and our employees do too. When we did the contract survey before we started negotiations, over 2.5 years ago, our employees said, you know, merit promotions, work at home, and the appraisal system are the biggest, are three of the big issues that they're interested in. I haven't mentioned work at home. That's another thing. We have very few people in SSA work at home. It's about 3,000 people total. And the agency's reluctant to let anyone else work at home. Operations, which is the people I represent work in operations, they're the ones who take claims, who work with a computer. You got to work with a computer in order to take claims, in order to process claims, in order to authorize claims. The agency has refused to allow those people to work at home, despite the fact that the Obama administration is pushing work at home, and that work at home results in tax savings because you need less office space. It has other ancillary benefits in terms of the environment. If people are at home instead of driving to work, you know, there's less pollution, and certainly it's a convenience matter for people who work at home, and they don't have to spend the time they spend commuting is time that they have to deal with their families and their free time. And a lot of private sector is moving towards expanded work at home too, but in SSA we've in fact have less people working at home now than we had 5 years ago. And it's all about having access to the database. And I can understand certain concerns about that, but other agencies have cut through that. OPM, which processes claims for federal employees, retirement disability, those people can work at home up to 4 days a week. The VA, VA employees who process veterans claims, they can work at home. Department of Labor employees who process workman's comp claims for federal employees, they can work at home. So, you know, I don't know, and there's no evidence that in those agencies that ability to work at home has been detrimental to the public in terms of having their private information accessed by inappropriately. And so we think it's a philosophical thing with the current Commissioner Astruz, where he doesn't think people ought to work at home. He's against it. And so we're going to the mat on that, trying to get expanded work at home opportunities for our employees.
How optimistic are you that the 5 outstanding articles will be able to be resolved quickly and be able to move forward?
Well, it's a matter of timing. I mean, if we can get it, and it's a matter of what's going to happen in the elections. I mean, the elections are critical. You know, what happened when Bush became president is he fired all the members of the Federal Services Impasses Panel when he became president, and he picked people like who were on the Heritage Foundation who displayed an anti-union bent. And the Impasses Panel, I know CMS took their contract to the Impasses Panel, and they got filleted. They threw in like about, I think, 30-some articles, and they lost every one but one. And I think, you know, you had a philosophy there where, you know, the panel was going to look, was more apt to buy language that the agency proposed in the union. Well, when Bush was elected president, yeah, he fired that panel and hired, and we have a new panel, which we think is not necessarily pro-union, but more balanced. So one of the reasons that we've gone to the panel at this time was to hope that the current panel will make a decision, because we don't know what's going to happen in the election, you know. And presumably if Romney wins, he'll do the same thing that Bush did. So, you know, it's part of it's a lot of timing. So I'm relatively optimistic. I think we have good arguments for our proposal if you have a panel that's even-handed. Let's put it that way.
Witold Skwierczynski, the president of AFGE's SSA Council 220 Field Operations Locals. Witold, it is always a pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you for coming by and seeing us today.
You're welcome. Love to be here. Love to spread the message.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll continue from AFGE's National Convention with AFGE Housing and Urban Development Council 222 Executive Vice President Carolyn Federoff.
Did you know MetLife Auto and Home has valuable deals on insurance for AFGE members that could save them hundreds every year? Benefits include special discounts just for being an AFGE member, and in most states, a deductible credit for claim-free driving up to $250. To see how much you could save, call the AFGE Benefits Hotline at 1-888-844-2343 to get the members-only phone number from MetLife. That's 1-888-844-2343. Underwritten by Metropolitan Group Property and Casualty Insurance Company, Warwick, Rhode Island.
Planning a family vacation? Did you know through your AFGE membership, you are eligible for discounts for you and your family when you travel to Busch Gardens, Adventure Island, Knott's Berry Farm, and SeaWorld? And if you want to capture those family moments on film, your union membership will help you get a discount on a camcorder or digital camera. Those are just some of the benefits offered by the American Federation of Government Employees, the nation's largest federal workers union, representing some 600,000 workers nationwide. If you are a member, simply go to the AFGE website and click on the Member Benefits tab or call 888-844-2343. That's 888-844-2343. Not a member? Become one. Log on to AFGE.org and click the Join AFGE button on the homepage. AFGE, proud to make America work.
Attention AFGE members. Did you know about AFGE's new service to assist you with legal rights issues? It's called the AFGE Legal Rights Attorney Program, which offers free attorney representation in cases brought by AFGE councils and locals on behalf of AFGE members. The program, administered by AFGE's General Counsel's Office, has handled more than 150 cases since 2005 and has won millions of dollars in back pay for our members. The Legal Rights Attorney Program is designed to take cases that will be brought to arbitration, the Merit System Protection Board, or other review boards where both back pay and attorney's fees are available. These cases include removal, suspension, reduction in pay, reduction in grade, and furlough. For information about the program, please email legalrights@afge.org. Not a member? Become one and take advantage of this incredible resource today.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined again by Carolyn Federoff, the Executive Vice President of AFGE's Housing and Urban Development Council 222. Carolyn, welcome back to the program.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
Carolyn, the big news of the week, of course, is Governor Mitt Romney, the GOP nominee for president, selecting Congressman Paul Ryan from Wisconsin to be his VP running mate. What is your reaction to that selection?
Iceberg dead ahead. Frankly, the Ryan budget is ready to sink government as we know it. You know, they have a saying, you know, over the Republican Party, they keep saying they're going to take our country back, and I think they're going to take it back 125 years, to a point in time that even Teddy Roosevelt wouldn't recognize the United States government. Now, there's going to be a lot of talk during this election about what the Ryan budget does for Social Security, for Medicare and Medicaid. But I think as federal employees, we need to be focused on what that budget does to the rest of us. According to the Congressional Budget Office, the Ryan budget takes what we now spend 12% of our GDP, our gross domestic product, on. And over the course of a couple decades, he would cram that down into 4.25% of GDP, a two-thirds reduction. In every other part of government outside of Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. The other important thing to remember is that, according to the CBO, at no time since World War II have we spent less than 4% of GDP on defense. So that spending 4.25%, who is going to patrol our borders? Who is going to inspect our food? Who is going to direct air traffic? Who is going to put up satellites in order to have good weather predictions and good cell phone service? This cannot possibly be a form of government that even conservatives would find acceptable in this country.
So what do you think the appropriate response is to the budget? What should be done?
Well, I think for one thing, as government employees, we need to stop saying, cut the other guy. Because there cannot possibly be enough cuts in any one of us in order to offset the cuts that have been proposed by Governor Romney and Congressman Paul Ryan. For us to become divided, to say, you know, for the housing and urban development people to say, just take it out of defense, and for the defense people to say, oh, just take it out of EPA, there is not enough money in their budget to save any one of us.
Let's look at how these cuts would impact your agency, the Housing and Urban Development. What would it look like if these cuts were put into place? What would that mean to the agency, the workers, and most importantly, the service to the American people?
I mean, if in fact these cuts were taken proportionately, which they won't be, but let's assume that two-thirds of the cuts would come off of every agency, that would put approximately 800,000 elders out on the street without housing. It would put 800,000 low-income families out on the street without housing. We're talking about approximately 2 million children who would be without housing. Do we want that sort of a homeless problem in this country when we have come so far in the last 15 years battling homelessness, and we will be right back in it within two decades?
So clearly, then, there is a very black and white choice about how to move forward.
It is so stark. It is so startling of a choice that I cannot. This is not conservative versus liberal. This is radical, radical beyond our wildest imagination.
So let me ask you then, because obviously these proposals coming from the congressman are in reaction to the budget problems, the deficit that the nation faces. How would you address those problems?
The fact is, we as citizens have been complicit in a decade of poor management of our government. We allowed our government to cut taxes that we could not afford to cut. We allowed our government to engage in two wars that we were not willing to pay for. And a decade of profligacy means that, unfortunately, we're all waking up from a hangover, and we're all going to have to contribute in order to get out of this mess.
And so let's talk about that contribution. We know, obviously, that federal employees are contributing through a pay freeze of at least 2 years. We're talking about higher increases in their pension plans, the health benefits that they have. Rates go up every year. Who else should be contributing?
We, as an electorate, as citizens of this country, all of us, dug this hole. We cannot ask just a few people to fill the hole back. And in fact, even the proposal to increase taxes on incomes of $250,000 and above, to tax only the upper 2% or 5% of income earners in this country, is not sufficient. This is a huge hole. we all contributed to it, and frankly, we're all going to have to contribute to fill that hole in. But what I want to remind people is, not that it should happen next year, but within the next 4 years, we need to return to the Clinton-era tax rates. And was the Clinton era really such a terrible era? In 2000, didn't all of us feel great that we were paying down the deficit, that we were living within our means? Wasn't 2000 a great year? And so why should we be afraid to return to those tax rates at a time when we all felt pretty good about ourselves?
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're here with Carolyn Fedoroff, the Executive Vice President of AFGE's Housing and Urban Development Council 222. Carolyn, will generating more revenue be enough?
It's not enough, because people will demand that the government be more efficient and that we do our work better. But there has been a laser focus just on cuts and a fear of talking about revenue. And I believe as federal employees, we need to stop being afraid of talking about revenue. We need to talk about revenue. You just cannot work for 10 years and have wars and financial crises and underfund your government, and the next day wake up and decide you're not going to talk about revenues.
To this point, you put together a presentation, a video presentation, where you analyzed the data of what those cuts would mean, how they would impact agencies, and in some cases, almost obliterate entire agencies altogether. Tell us about that presentation and some of the statistics that you uncovered.
Yes, in December, I read a poll from my home state of Massachusetts where a third of Massachusetts citizens believed that we could balance the budget through cuts alone, and I started to think, well, what would that look like? So I pulled up the Office of Management and Budget statistics for FY11, and I looked at the fact that we spent $3.6 trillion, but we only took in $2.3 trillion, and what would it take to cut $1.3 trillion out of our budget? And as I looked at agency budgets, I came to realize that we would have to eliminate every single agency except for the mandatory programs in VA, which is about 55% of the VA budget, Medicare and Medicaid and HHS, which is about 84% of their government, the interest payments in Treasury, which is about 92% of theirs, and even after having eliminated every single other agency, we'd still have to take 26% out of the defense budget if we were to only spend what we brought in last year. It is a stark reality to recognize that we are spending so far beyond the revenue that we bring in. We truly do have a problem.
One of the things that you mentioned as a contributing factor to the enormous deficit is some poor management at the agency level. Let's talk about some of those things, maybe a fix or two where you think things could be done a little bit more efficiently or a little bit better.
It's almost unfair of me to pick on the defense budget because I'm not a defense employee. And so I feel a little uncomfortable doing it. However, there have been several reports that have stated that during the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, there was so much money being shoveled at the Department of Defense that they were insufficiently staffed in order to accurately monitor and keep track of those contracts. This is a clear indication that we need more civilian staff in order to correctly monitor those contracts. And if we had that civilian staff, we could, in fact, save quite a bit of money from the defense budget. But we can't do it without having our civilian employees there to monitor that funding.
So at the time, you're saying that perhaps beefing up the staff, which may have been, in the short term, adding a little bit of money, in the long term would have saved a lot by being able to keep track of those contracts.
Absolutely. And that's also true for Social Security. For Social Security, they have shown where having more money in the claims review process, having more staff in the claims review process, saves a substantial portion of funding for claims that are fraudulent. We have cut our staff so much, and of course the proposals to just have across-the-board cuts further exacerbate the problem, of just having insufficient watchdogs over the funding stream.
Of course, as we mentioned, Americans are going to have a very clear choice in the presidential election, which is coming up in November. What will you be doing between now and then to spread your message and talk to people?
I believe that we have a unique opportunity working through the union movement, through the AFL-CIO, to help our brothers and sisters in the union movement really understand the funding issues that this government faces, to help them understand that this is not just a matter of cut, but that this is a matter of pay. We need to pay for this. And every labor candidate is going to be pummeled by the other side, that we need to cut, and we need to give them the strength to say, no, we need to pay.
Carolyn Fedoroff, AFGE's Executive Vice President for Council 222 Housing and Urban Development. Carolyn, it is always a pleasure to have you on the program. Thanks for sharing your time today.
Thank you so much. Glad I could be here.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll continue from AFGE's National Convention with former National President Bobby Harnage.
Did you know MetLife Auto and Home has valuable deals on insurance for AFGE members that could save them hundreds every year? Benefits include special discounts just for being an AFGE member, and in most states, a deductible credit for claim-free driving up to $250. To see how much you could save, call the AFGE Benefits Hotline at 1-888-844-2343 to get the members-only phone number from MetLife. That's 1-888-844-2343. Underwritten by Metropolitan Group Property and Casualty Insurance Company, Warwick, Rhode Island.
Planning a family vacation? Did you know through your AFGE membership you are eligible for discounts for you and your family when you travel to Busch Gardens, Adventure Island, Knott's Berry Farm, and SeaWorld? And if you want to capture those family moments on film, your union membership will help you get a discount on a camcorder or digital camera. Those are just some of the benefits offered by the American Federation of Government Employees, the nation's largest federal workers union, representing some 600,000 workers nationwide. If you are a member, simply go to the AFGE website and click on the Member Benefits tab or call 888-844-2343. That's 888-844-2343. Not a member? Become one. Log on to AFGE.org and click the Join AFGE button on the homepage. AFGE, proud to make America work.
Attention AFGE members. Did you know about AFGE's new service to assist you with legal rights issues? It's called the AFGE Legal Rights Attorney Program, which offers free attorney representation in cases brought by AFGE councils and locals on behalf of AFGE members. The program, administered by AFGE's General Counsel's Office, has handled more than 150 cases since 2005 and has won millions of dollars in back pay for our members. The Legal Rights Attorney Program is designed to take cases that will be brought to arbitration, the Merit System Protection Board, or other review boards where both back pay and attorney's fees are available. These cases include removal, suspension, reduction in pay, reduction in grade, and furlough. For information about the program, please email legalrights@afge.org. Not a member? Become one and take advantage of this incredible resource today.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by former AFGE National President Bobby Harnage. President Harnage, welcome to the program.
Well, it's good to be here. It's really doing an outstanding job.
We sit here today at AFGE's National Convention in Las Vegas. Tell me some of the sights and sounds that you've taken in so far.
Well, I just got here about 30, 45 minutes ago, but the same enthusiasm as you see over the years, the delegates coming in and getting registered and seeing each other, people that they hadn't seen for 3 years, and some, you know, they're building coalitions on issues that they want to be for or against. It's always interesting to watch the little gatherings get together and do their plotting and their planning, all for the best.
When you look back on your career in the labor movement and particularly as the national president at AFGE, what comes to mind as your proudest accomplishments?
Well, there's so many issues. The proudest accomplishment is we're still here. because they was definitely between Reagan and the two Bushes. We're lucky to even be still existing, and there was a time that it looked very doubtful. The contracting out, you know, we've continued to have that fight, but we continue to win it in most cases. And I can remember when I was meeting with the Clinton administration, they were doing, that's when the Republicans had control of the Senate and the House, and they was doing some movement to privatize DOD. And it was 10:30 at night when one of the cabinet members called me and said, "This is the bottom line. You got to give us a decision." And I gave it to him, and that decision has prevailed. But it's just the same fights over and over. I don't know if there's any one thing that stands out because they were so many, but the contracting out and survival, I guess, is one thing that AFG has been the best at.
Talk about that and what that means to you, that the union has continued on and is thriving and moving forward and really doing a lot of great things for its membership.
Well, that's true. And going back, you know, I joined the union when I was 24 years old. I became an employee, a national representative at 28. I was the youngest national rep ever hired at that point. I think they've hired some younger ones since then. But over those years, 35 years, I've served full-time with AFG, longest-serving national officer on the NEC. I've seen a lot of things come and go, seen a lot of people come and go. But we've always been able to pull it together in hard times. I guess if I had to really say what was my proudest moment was when we called all of the local leaders together in Chicago. Everybody said, "It can't be done. You're crazy for doing it. It's unheard of. You're going to let the grassroots run the union." You know? But we pulled everybody into that meeting hall, and there were several thousand people there. We spent the time and sat down and developed a program, AFGE for the Future. That was a good program, and that got us to where we're at today. Some of it wasn't followed through, but most of it was the organizing program. We've grown over 70,000 members. That was the 2003 convention action. Now that was part of that AFGE of the Future program. So that would be one of my proudest accomplishments, even though it wasn't 100% implemented. It was about 50% implemented, but I wasn't there to do it.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're here with former AFGE National President Bobby Harnage. When you look back from the start of your career in the labor movement until now, what comes to mind the most as something that has changed or been a big influence?
I guess the biggest change I've seen is the politics. I can remember, the Richard Russell days, the Carl Vinson days, the Herman Talmadge, the Middle Rivers, people that were statesmen and people that worked together, Democrat or Republican. They communicated with each other. They respected each other representing their constituencies. Now, there was compromise, and compromise wasn't a bad word. Compromise was good because they reached an agreement that moved forward. It might not have been 100%, but it was a forward movement. People now, a backward movement is acceptable even though they lose. So, and the bitterness of the politics of the day.
What scares you about that? That sounds like a dangerous proposition, being willing to lose or move backwards.
I think that's the ultra-conservative of this country. Big business has taken over the politics of this nation, and if the middle class don't wake up, there's going to be some irrevocable things that's going to be accomplished in the next 6 years. So I don't understand what's wrong with talking, but it started really with the Reagan administration. Newt Gingrich is the one that really got it off the ground, to where if you were not a Republican, they didn't even talk to you. If you was a Democrat lobbyist with some issues that you needed to talk to a congressman, they had instruction, don't talk to Democrat lobbyists. Where I was able to come and go on Capitol Hill and talk to anybody and everybody, all of a sudden the doors was closed. No Republican wanted to be talking to a union leader. which was absurd. You know, we had good ideas. Under the partnership program of Bill Clinton, we proved that if you listen to employees, you can improve productivity and reduce the cost. We proved that. Why walk away from that advantage? But they walked away and didn't care how much it cost or how much damage it done, because what's driving them is the almighty dollar, not the efficiency, the almighty dollar.
Tell me about your time working in the federal government. What brought you to service?
Well, that's a long story. I was somewhat of a maverick. I had some instructions to do something that I felt was wrong. I had seen other people be required to do it, and I had told my supervisors that it was wrong, and if they ever asked me to do it, I wouldn't do it. So they concocted the opportunity to ask me, and I wouldn't do it. And so they tried to fire me, but the judge advocate's office wouldn't let them, so they wound up with a 2-week suspension. I appealed out and represented myself in that appeal and won it, and they had to give me my pay back and purge my record. So the union asked me if wouldn't I like to be a shop steward, and so I became a shop steward, and then there was a vacancy in the local office, and I stepped into that, and we went to Washington lobbying. Back then, we was lobbying on the pay for blue-collar workers. It had not been changed in 104 years. And every year, you had to introduce new legislation for a white-collar pay increase, and it may take 2 years to get it passed. It wasn't every year. So we were fighting for an improvement in the white-collar. And I met a lot of congressmen and senators, and I come from Washington extremely impressed. I can remember Richard Russell telling us he would support us on our pay, but we had to understand the military got it too. And we said, look, we're from a military institution. We don't have a problem with military getting it. Everybody is entitled to a raise. So I was really impressed with Congress, and that I went home and told myself, you got to get more involved in this, and I did.
What was your favorite thing about being a part of the labor movement and serving?
I guess the politics of it, well, not the internal politics of AFG, but being able to meet with leaders, the leaders of this nation. You know, I met with most the cabinet members under the Clinton administration. I had a monthly meeting with four of them on a regular basis. Was at the Pentagon 3 or 4 times a month. Once a month was on the National Partnership Council. Being able to meet with people at that level and make a difference was awesome. It was also an aging process, too, thinking of, you know, this one time I had to make a decision and 2 million people could lose their job. You know, that's a lot of stress. They didn't lose their job. But that was the awesome of being able to meet with leaders and make a difference.
As you look ahead to the rest of 2012 and beyond, what are you hoping to see from the labor movement?
Well, I think the labor movement has got to sit down and really analyze where they've been and where they're going. And there's some issues that they may need to step aside from. And there's some issues they need to pay more attention to. The labor movement is looked at as bleeding liberals, and in reality, they're not. But we need to eliminate that image. We're very conservative, fiscally conservative, and we're very hawk. We're not doves. There's a group of us that are doves, but most of them are hawks and support the military and the national security. So I would like to see the unions look at it in a little different approach on some issues.
Bobby Harnage, the former president of AFGE, it was a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you to our guests this week, AFGE SSA Council 220 President Witold Skwierczynski, Housing and Urban Development Council 222 Executive Vice President Carolyn Fedoroff, and former National President Bobby Harnage. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and that's The View from Inside Government.
Thank you for listening.